Thanks for joining us. I'm Katty Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. For those of you who didn't know, Diane had an accident last week. She fell and cracked her pelvis, but she is making good progress and moves to physical therapy today. We all wish her well. Author Gwen Cooper says her new book is different from most pet memoirs because it has a happy ending. But the story didn't start that way. In a foreword, veterinarian Patricia Cooley describes the minuscule two-week-old kitten who showed up at her office one day. He had an eye infection so severe she had to surgically remove his eyes to save his life. Afterwards, though, he bounced back to life, but no one wanted to adopt him. Until one young woman with two cats of her own had a look. Gwen Cooper joins me in the studio to describe what she saw in that little blind kitten and how he grew into a fearless feline. Her memoir is titled Homer's Odyssey. Gwen, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. And of course, best wishes to Ms. Rehm for a speedy recovery.
Well, thank you very much. I know she'll appreciate that. We will be opening the phones to all our listeners on 1-800-433-8850 in just a while. Please do call us with your questions and comments and your own stories as well. And you can send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Homer's Odyssey, Gwen. What was happening in your life when your vet called you that day, you were living in Miami, and said to you, I've got this little kitten, but he's blind?
I was probably about as unsettled as I have been at any point in my adult life. I had just broken up with a man who I had been with for 3 years. We were living together. I had always assumed that we would be getting married. And we did not get married. And so I was staying in a friend's spare bedroom while I tried to sort my life out. I was working a nonprofit, which was work that I found very fulfilling. But as a single person now living on that income, it was sort of difficult. It was obvious to me that long term, it was not going to be a viable option.
And you were 24 years old?
24, 25. Yeah, it was 12, 13 years ago. And so, yes. So, and I had two cats already who had been uprooted from their lives, and they were okay. They were rolling with it. But it was really one of those moments in life where nothing was very settled, not my relationships, not my career, not even my living situation.
And one of those moments in life where taking on another pet really didn't seem like a very good idea.
No. And to tell you the truth, that was my main objection at first. It wasn't even so much about the cat being blind. Or it was insofar as I wondered if I was stable enough to create the kind of stable environment that a special needs pet might have. But it seemed as if it was not the right time to take on a third pet at all.
So your veterinarian calls you.
Yes.
Get the phone call.
Yes. My veterinarian called me at work one day. And she launches into the story, which, as I say in the book, you know, if there were a station called Lifetime for Cats, it would have been a perfect made-for-TV movie. and basically tells me about this, at the, you know, then three-week-old kitten. Whose eyes had to be surgically removed, and she, you know, the couple that had brought him in planning to adopt him no longer wanted him. And she had this whole list of people who specifically, an adoption list of people who'd specifically expressed an interest in adopting a handicapped cat. And none of them wanted this particular handicap or this particular cat. And she was really out of options. She sort of knew it was not an ideal moment in my life, but she could not bring this. She had a toddler who was allergic to cats. She couldn't bring him home with her and was, I think, sort of starting to get desperate. And so she makes this call, and I, of course, you know, am in tears. And there's this part of my brain that's thinking, it's not a good idea. It's not a good idea. It's not the right time. So, you know, I sort of said to her, I was like, well, I'll meet him, but I'm not promising anything. And it was just really a moving story.
What I loved was the honesty with which you said you drove home, you know, you drove to the vet surgery after work in Miami, and basically, you were driving there in order to be able to say no, but to be able to say it politely.
That was really it. You know, because the thing is, I had never been the kind of person who said, I need to meet the pet in question, and then I'll make a decision about adoption. In my family, we adopted and fostered numerous dogs, and I had adopted two cats. And we always, based upon availability, if we were in a place where we could bring home another pet, then we did. And the issues of the personality, how we would feel or react to them. You know, our feeling was always sort of they're like children. You get what you get, and you love them, and you work with them. And if there are problems, you work through the problems. So I felt very dishonest saying I have to meet him before I can make a decision, because that had never been my philosophy. And I, you know, I felt that what she was hearing was, great, somebody's going to come down and might adopt the cat. And what I was thinking was, I didn't have it in me to say no after hearing that whole story, but I really do intend to say no. And so that was my thought process as I was driving down there.
Tell me what happened when you first met Homer.
You know, he was tiny, and that right off the bat, he was just so tiny, and he was only about 3 weeks old.
It has
so
to be said that there's nothing cuter ounces. Than a tiny little kitten.
They're so little and cute at that age, and he had that one of those enormous. He still had stitches from the surgery, so he had one of those enormous cones around his head that they put around animals to keep them from scratching out stitches, which was just it was so like pathetic and adorable at the same time. And but what really impressed me, you know, when I picked him up, he was so happy and friendly. He just started purring. He was nuzzling me. He was so ready and willing to engage new people and to expect the best in life, even given what he'd already been through in his very short life. And, you know, of course, I was at this point like, oh, I'm broke. And, oh, I just had a breakup and life is so hard. And I just in that moment felt so ashamed of myself. You know, here is this cat whose experience has made my worst days look like a week at Disney World. And he was happy and fearless and ready to engage the world with so much joy. And really why I ended up bringing him home was in that moment, I felt that I wanted to be a better person. I wanted to be as good of a person as he was a cat. And that to me was just right from the beginning, he was inspirational.
And your vet was convinced that he could lead a normal life. Why was that?
Well, she had worked with special needs pets previously. And it should also be noted that kittens are born with their eyes closed and they don't open them for about the first 2 weeks of life. So by the time, you know, Homer had probably had this infection from birth. And by the time he would have been about to open his eyes, the infection was already progressed enough that he wasn't able to see. So her feeling was that he would just not know that there was such a thing as vision. And that he was missing it. You know, I think what she said to me at the time is, it's not like the other cats are going to say, hey, you're blind. And there was just no reason for him not, you know, that he would just grow up and adapt, never having known what vision was, and so never needing to overcome anything.
Presumably because cats also have so many well-developed other sensory perceptions, he could get around much better than, say, you or I.
Oh, yeah, well, absolutely. He has his whiskers, which right off the top are just a wonderful sensory tool and that help you know where solid objects are in relation to where you are. And his hearing and his sense of smell with cats in general are certainly more developed than yours or mine, and Homer in particular. I always say he's a cat with superpowers. He's like the comic book superhero Daredevil. He's this extraordinary sense of hearing and this extraordinary sense of smell. If he wanted to, he could be a drug sniffing dog cat. it's just he can tell the difference between a can of tuna fish. And a can of tomato soup while they're still in the can, in a sealed can. It's unbelievable.
And what did the vet tell you other people had said to her about why they didn't want to adopt a blind cat? Because you write in the book that the statistics actually for blind cats to be adopted are very low, that it's very difficult to get a blind cat to be adopted.
Well, interestingly, the two strikes that Homer had against him, in addition to his blindness, he's also an all-black cat. And this was something that really astonished me when I learned it. But the overwhelming majority, upwards of 90% of black cats are not in shelters, end up not being adopted. People don't want to adopt black cats. I know. It would never have occurred to me. I agree. So she wasn't very specific about the specific objections that people had given. But I think it's safe to assume. I think a lot of people, you know, I don't know. It's something I wonder about. I think part of it is the hesitancy or the reluctance to take on a cat that has special needs. I think some people really do genuinely think that it is cruel to make an animal live that life. I think some people really thought that he would have been better off having been put to sleep. And I think, you know, perhaps there's, and Homer, by the way, I should say, and there are plenty of pictures of him in the book, he just always looks like he has his eyes closed. If you just saw him in passing, you would not, it would take a minute to register that there was anything different about it. But I'm sure that people heard no eyes and imagine something very grotesque in their minds. And we're probably leery on that score as well.
But you say that when you first met him, you hadn't known what to expect. from the surgery, but that you could see movement around his eyes and could kind of tell his expression from that.
Yeah, that's very true. If you do pay attention to Homer's face, and certainly I know it very well by now. And but even when I first picked him up, you know, the muscles around the eyelids are still all there. Like if you kind of blow softly in his face, they squinch up as if he were trying to close his eyelids. And and so he actually does have a very expressive little face. And I also say in the book that, you know, what I thought some people might be hesitant about is that if a cat doesn't have eyes, then how will its face be able to register love? How will you look at this animal and see love reflected back in his face? And he really does have a very expressive little face. And again, that was something that surprised me when I first picked him up. He just, you know, his muscles sort of flattened out into that look that my other two cats wear when they're very happy and they're getting rubbed exactly the way they like it. And they are just purring like crazy and their eyes half closed and this just, you know, complete expression of complete happiness. And that was the look on his face when I first picked him up. And that was also the end of me. I mean, really, it was, you know, I picked him up. I held him for about 30 seconds. And I believe what I said to the vet is, wrap him up. I'm taking him home. And that was that.
But you didn't have a name for him straight away.
I did not. You know, I originally, what I say in the book actually was that I'd always said if I was going to adopt a third cat, I would name him Meow Tse Tung and call him the Chairman for short. And he would be Little Chairman Meow. But that did not seem appropriate in this case. I was originally going to call him Oedipus and call him Eddie for short. I've always been a big fan of Greek mythology, and it just seemed completely appropriate. My roommate at the time thought that that would be a mean name. And people were suggesting Stevie or Ray as a perfect name for a blind black cat, and it just didn't feel right. And I finally settled on Homer for a lot of reasons, but in the end, aside from loving Greek mythology and knowing that Homer, the Greek poet, was blind, that I just always foresaw this epic life for this cat.
Gwen Cooper is the author of Homer's Odyssey. It is her new book, and we will be taking your calls and questions after this short break. Stay listening. Welcome back. I'm Catty Kay, sitting in for Diane Rehm. My guest this hour is Gwen Cooper. She is the author of Homer's Odyssey, a fearless feline tale, or How I Learned About Love and Life with a Blind Wonder Cat. Gwen, I want to talk a little bit about when you first got Homer home. You'd taken him back from the vet and you watched him as he moved around your apartment. How did he negotiate your apartment? How does he negotiate the world outside?
Well, you know, there's Homer knowing a space, and then there's Homer getting to know a space. Homer knowing a space, and he does get to know spaces very, very quickly. You would never know that he was blind to see him walking around. And I think that is always the most surprising thing for people who meet him for the first time. The only troubles he runs into are due to my sloppiness. You know, if I leave a pair of shoes in an unaccustomed place on the floor, he will walk right into them and kind of be like, hey, what's that doing there? And then sort of walk around. But then he'll keep walking around that spot for a couple of days, you know, as if he has it in his head. Okay, there was something there. It might still be there. When Homer's getting to know a new space, he really, the first thing he does is he walks around the perimeter. He finds a wall and he follows the wall and the shape of the room, and his whiskers tell him where the wall is. And he does that once or twice. And then he kind of walks through the space itself. If he hits a piece of furniture, he sort of stretches up it, tries to climb it. I think, tries to get a sense of its dimensions, its texture, what it is, if it's a table, if it's a couch, if it's something, a counter that he won't be able to climb. And he does that a couple of times. And then he really just gets around. And again, I always say, you know, I always come back to the Daredevil reference, you know, Daredevil, the superhero who could apparently create a radar image in his head based on sounds or whatever. What a room looked like, or what its layout was. Homer, it's just really astonishing how quickly and easily he masters new spaces and gets around the spaces that he knows.
Were you surprised when you got him home that this happened so easily for him? Were you expecting more of an adjustment in your life for a blind cat?
I can't say that I was surprised or unsurprised. I had concerns, and I really didn't know. My vet had experience working with special needs pets. I really did not. So I tried to think through what all of the difficulties would be, and then hoped that they wouldn't turn out to be difficulties. And which, as turned out to be the case, really, I was probably overly cautious at first. I was probably more concerned than I needed to be.
But there are things that you do and that you've always done to help him out. You always leave his food, for example,
yes,
in the same place.
His litter box is always in the same place. His food and water are always in the same place when I move. And it is rightfully called an odyssey. I think I moved about 6 times in the past 12 years. Not on the run from the law or anything, just because career and life has sort of dictated it. And so the first thing I do, as opposed to the other two cats, when I take Homer out of his carrier, I put him in his litter box so that the litter box is the starting place, so that wherever he goes, wherever he learns how to get to, he always knows how to get back to the litter box. The food he usually can find on his own by scent, and then the water is kept right next to it. So he works it out really quickly.
And he's had a pretty adventurous life, your little blind kitten.
He has. It is a very action-adventure kind of life, a life with a lot of heroics and suspense and danger. And
the daredevil that he is.
Daredevil that he is, absolutely. It's, some are born to greatness and some have greatness thrust upon them. And truly, he has led, I think certainly for a cat, and actually even compared to me, I would say, an extraordinary life.
Tell me about the time he chased a stranger out of your house, an intruder.
An intruder, yeah. This was, Homer always slept in the bed with me. And the thing you have to understand right off the top about an eyeless black cat is that an eyeless black cat is invisible in the dark. You will hear him, you may, discern him in other ways, but you will not be able to see him. So it was about 4 in the morning, and I heard Homer growling. I had never heard him growl. Homer's a very friendly cat. He's an exceptionally friendly cat. But something was clearly bothering him, and I just knew that it was him growling, even though I'd never heard it before. But I couldn't see him. I couldn't see anything in the room. And so I reached and I turned on the lamp next to my bed. And, there was Homer on the bed, all puffed up and growling. And his ears were working furiously like a sonar dish, just going from side to side. And standing at the foot of the bed was a man who I had never seen before in my life. And which is a really terrifying moment. And I know I became very, very tense. My body just tensed up. And that, I think, was the point at which Homer really got upset. So Homer's growling. But, the funny part, looking back on it, because I'm terrified. And the intruder looks terrified, too, which at the time sort of like you broke into my apartment. What are you so freaked out about? But he, again, it took him a minute to figure out why he hadn't been able to see Homer, what it was about Homer that was different. And there was this look of terror on his face when he recognized what it was. And I always say, from his perspective, he doesn't know what kind of house he's just wandered into. Like, all of a sudden, there's this very aggressive, eyeless black cat threatening him. He probably thought he'd ended up in Hannibal Lecter's apartment or something. Like if she did that to the cat, what's she going to do to me? And so now we're all freaked out. And so I went to reach for the phone to dial 911. And he said, don't do that. And it was the first time he had spoken. And the thing with Homer is, for him to really pinpoint something, he needs a definite sound. And so once the man spoke, Homer knew where he was. And Homer went to claw at his, the claw came up and out and further than I had ever seen it extend before. And he went for the guy's face and missed really by the smallest fraction of an inch, because the guy, snapped his head back. And then, so I've got 911 on the phone. I've got the cat clawing at the man. The man at this point, between the police and the attack cat, decides it's time for him to leave. So he turns around and runs. And then Homer jumps off the bed and runs after him.
Homer wasn't going to let him get away.
No, Homer was angry. Homer really, I think, really felt for the, it was, I think, the first time in his life he'd ever really felt threatened
right.
by anything. You know, we had all, I mean, even my other two cats were always sort of very careful in how they played with him. And we'd all sort of gone out of our way to create this very secure and safe feeling environment for Homer. And I think it was the first time he'd ever felt threatened. And I think his reaction to that was anger, you know. And so he jumps off the bed. So I'm on the phone with 911 and they're saying, you know, stay on the phone with us till the police get there. But I can't let Homer run out of the apartment and into the hallways of this massive apartment complex that I was living in, because God knows where he'll end up and he won't be able to find his way back. So I'm now chasing the cat who's chasing the burglar when all I'd wanted was for the burglar to leave. And but I caught up with him finally, and the burglar got away. And I was actually pretty angry at Homer for, you know, it was one of those moments of intense fear that turns to intense anger. You know, I think I heard my mother's voice coming out of my mouth, like, when I say no, I mean no, you know, when I got back to the apartment. And but we made up shortly thereafter, and all was good.
And then you moved to New York, and you were living in New York during the attacks of 9/11.
Yes, I was actually living about five blocks away from the World Trade Center. I moved in the late winter, early spring of 2001. It was February or March. I had a job that was in the financial district, about six blocks away from the World Trade Center, and I had a friend who lived in an apartment building a block away from that. So at the time, it just seemed like this wonderful, you know, coincidence that everything had just worked out so perfectly. And I loved living where I lived, and I loved working where I worked. And so we were very close during the 9/11 attacks.
And the cats were all in the apartment?
The cats were in the apartment. The planes hit the towers right before I left for work that morning.
Right.
And they were very upset. Homer in particular. I thought it was a car backfiring, which sounds really stupid in retrospect. But again, at the time, my mind certainly would not have gone to terrorist attack or, you know, plane hitting the World Trade Center. And it was New York, and there's construction and traffic, and there are random loud noises, and that is life in the city. Homer was very upset, and I was a few minutes late leaving for work because I was trying to calm him down. But I didn't want to call in to work and say, I can't come to work. My cat's upset. So I walked out the front door, and that was the first time I had an understanding of what had happened. I looked over, and we were very close to the World Trade Center, and it was on fire. And I went to my office, and they evacuated the office building. And at the time, we had no idea that the towers were going to collapse. So a group of us from work, we didn't really want to be alone. We didn't want to go back to our homes in the area. So we decided to walk over the Brooklyn Bridge, which was very, very close to us. It was closer than going really any place in Manhattan. And we were going to walk over the bridge, and we didn't really have a specific plan, but we would be together. We would get away from it. And then later on, we would all go home. And while we were on the bridge was when the towers collapsed. And it ended up being several days before I was able to get back to rescue my cats. They weren't letting people back. At first, they had shut down the bridge. They opened the bridge, but they weren't letting people into Lower Manhattan. And so it was really several days of a lot of walking and a lot of begging and pleading. And the ASPCA actually was there, and they were ultimately very helpful in helping reunite people in the area with their pets. But, you know, I lived on the 31st floor of my apartment building, which had no electricity. So it took me 3 days to get back there. And on the day I got back, I had to walk from Chelsea Piers, which is probably about 3 miles from the apartment. And I had, you know, 7 pounds of cat litter and 2 gallons of water and all this food and flashlights and supplies for them. And then, of course, when I got to my building, I had to walk up the 31 flights of stairs to get back. I was actually,
and boy, they must have been happy to see you.
They were, pretty ecstatic. Scarlett, my oldest, she's a little bit of a curmudgeon. She was a little annoyed with me at first, I think. I think she just kind of was like, oh, look who finally remembered. She has cats. You know, thanks for showing up. We appreciate it. But the other, she relented eventually. Homer jumped right at the middle of my chest. I believe he weighs 3 pounds and he about knocked me down. They were very happy when I got back.
The book begins with a breakup.
Yes.
And you write, I know you write this in the book, that you saw this as an odyssey, a bit like Homer's odyssey.
Yes.
Your relationship with Homer has taken you through a very different stage of your life. And in a sense, I felt reading the book that it was as much about you and your development and your relationships as it with the cat, but also with the rest of your life?
Well, I think what the book is really about, ultimately, you know, there are a lot of individual stories and feats of daring and heroics and, you know, danger and suspense and drama and all of that. But ultimately, what I think is at the center of the book and of this story is the transformative relationship between this cat and me. My husband always says that it's a classic boy and his dog story, even though, you know, Homer's a cat and I'm a girl. But there's that sense where it's the things that happen, but it's also the way that the two change each other. And so I very much feel that in addition to the things that Homer has done that is remarkable, from my perspective, one of the most remarkable things about this relationship that I've had with this cat is how he has changed my life and the person who I sort of grew up into.
And your husband, too, came into the story.
Yes.
Once Homer was already there.
Oh, yes. I was married almost exactly a year ago, September 13th.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And my husband, we moved in with my husband 3 or 4 years ago. So these are already cats who we have been a unit for a long time. And now there's this fourth, you know, this fifth, rather, entity suddenly added into the mix. And he was not a cat person. He grew up with dogs and he had never lived with cats and was not in the abstract. He wasn't one of those people who dislikes cats in the abstract, but he was also not a person who in the abstract had ever been curious about cats. And so it was a little bit of an adjustment at first, a lot of which is detailed in the book. He also has this very loud, this wonderful voice, this wonderful, rich, booming baritone voice, which I love. But I always say that to poor Homer, who's so tiny and blind, it must just sound like the booming voice of God.
Zeus has come.
That's exactly it. And because Homer reacts to Lawrence's voice more than I've ever seen him react to anybody's voice except mine. And it was quite startling for him at first.
I'm Catty Kay, and you are listening to The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join us, please do call 1-800-433-8850 or send us an email to drshow@wmu.org. You can find us on Facebook, or you can send us a tweet to Gwen Cooper. She is the author of Homer's Odyssey. We are going to go to the phones now to Cynthia in San Antonio, Texas. Cynthia.
Hi.
Thank you for joining the program.
Thanks for having me. It's a great story, and I wanted to share my Christmas story. I took my 11-year-old daughter to the Animal Defense League the day before Christmas, and there was a blind kitty, or he had one eye that was blind, and she fell in love with him. And I kept saying, why do you love this cat so much? And she said, Mama, because if we don't take this kitty, nobody will. And I said, oh, that's not true. And I had some bias because I thought those little Siamese kittens were so cute. And this little kitty that we ended up naming Wink, we just, he basically won us over a four-hour period where we both watched how no one that came in there even gave him the time of day, even though he was doing all the tricks and jumping around. And it was a real reminder to me that children and animals are our best teachers, because Wink has the most special soul in the world.
Cynthia, that sounds quite a lot like your story, Gwen.
Yeah, I was going to say your daughter was absolutely right and very insightful. I think it is true that there is so much that we can learn from children and animals, and I think always that understanding between the two. But your daughter was right, unfortunately, that so many people don't want to adopt a cat that is handicapped or has special needs, and yet, as it sounds like you have discovered there, it can be just such a rewarding experience. And I always say, you know, you're saving two lives, because you're saving the life of the cat you adopt, and then you're also making room for another cat to find a shelter and a home, because the special needs cat would probably not have been adopted.
And it sounds like enriching your own life in the process.
Absolutely. It's really been probably the most, you know, rewarding experience
of
my life.
I'm still fascinated by Lawrence and what he first thought when you told him you had not just three cats, but one of them was blind. And this is somebody who is not a cat lover. It's one thing for cat lovers, but a totally different thing for somebody who is not a cat lover to take on quite that menagerie.
Yes. Well, here's the thing with Lawrence and I. We were actually very good friends. We were each other's best friends for several years before we became romantically involved. So it was one of those things where by the time we did become a couple, he couldn't, you know, he knew I had these cats and he knew that one of them was blind. And he couldn't act like it was a big surprise or if I had known this, I might have done things or felt differently. It was sort of already past that point by the time we got together. So he was already sort of half committed to having to eventually live with three cats as soon as he made the decision to get together with me.
And I want to hear a little bit, too, about how your other two cats have responded to Homer and how they responded when he first came home, because they were already pretty established with you.
Yes. Well, you know, Scarlett, my oldest, who I always say she's a cat who doesn't really like cats. She doesn't really like anybody except me. She's just that cat. I always say I feel like a woman with an abusive boyfriend when I talk about our relationship, because I always have to say, you don't know what she's really like, and you don't know what she's like when we're alone together. She's totally different. She's not a very friendly cat. It took her a little while to adjust she's the oldest, so each time I brought a new cat home, it took her a minute to adjust. You know, the thing is that Homer, for whatever reason, I think because he knows it irritates her, he loves to play with her and he loves to launch these mock attacks and play the big ferocious hunter. But he always tries to sneak up on her from the front, and it always mystifies him how she can just repel the attack.
Gwen Cooper is the author of Homer's Odyssey. We're going to hear about Homer's relationship with Scarlett after this short break. Please do stay listening. We'll be taking more of your calls and questions for Gwen Cooper on 1-800-433-8850. The email is drshow@wmu.org.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy, by NPR stations, by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, presenting an in-depth look at the digital generation at edutopia.org, and by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary on the web at healthreform.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Mike Judge, the creator of the animated series King of the Hill and Beavis and Butthead, and the director of Office Space, has written and directed a new film comedy starring Jason Bateman, Ben Affleck, and Kristen Wiig. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back. I'm Caddy Kay, sitting in for Diane Rehm, and I'm joined this hour by Gwen Cooper. She is the author of the novel Diary of a South Beach Party Girl. Her new book is Homer's Odyssey, a fearless feline tale. Let's go back to the phones again to Tripp in Ellicott City, Maryland. Tripp, you've joined the program.
Oh, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Gwen.
Good
and
morning.
Also, Diane, get well. Come on back. Back in the late 70s, I was driving along. I lived down in Anne Arundel County in the country, and there was a black cat sitting on the side of the road, kind of with the legs out like a sphinx or so, and I pulled over, and it had been hit by a car, brought it to my vet, and he wired its jaws shut. And so I fed it, got it well, and but I noticed there's something wrong with this cat. And the doctor goes, well, this cat's blind as a bat. And but it turned out to, just like you said, it would scope out using sonar or something like that and get around real well inside. Now, we live by the water and also in a rural setting, and the cat was wonderful outside. Hmm. But the only time it lost its bearings is when the wind blew, and it would the waves would come up and the leaves would rustle, and it would be completely disoriented.
Now, I was going to say this, that the scents change also. The wind blows the scents in from different directions, I would think.
Yeah, that, you never thought about that. But one day I was just watching it because it was sitting at attention, and I was looking at a little pile of leaves, and it got its right paw, and it real cleverly just shoved it into the leaves, and then it put its head in and pulled out a mouse. And I just could not believe it. I had so much respect for that cat. And he was just listening, and he just nailed it. It didn't kill it. I made him let it go.
Hey, Tripp, it sounds like you had a superhero as well. Gwen, that reminds me of the story in your book saying that Homer can catch flies.
Yes. Although before I talk about Homer, I do have to say, you know, it's interesting. My husband and I were just in Russia. We visited the Hermitage where they let many cats live there to catch the rats, to keep the rats from eating the paintings. And there's a book about it. The most famous mouser at the Hermitage is this blind cat who is the best at catching the mice. And it really is like a superhero kind of a thing, I think. But Homer is quite the superhero when it comes to ridding our apartment of pests and bugs. In Miami, this was an incredibly useful skill to have. And he can catch flies in midair.
Okay, tell me how he does it.
You know, it's you just see him sitting there, and I just see his head like toggling and his ears straight up, you know, back and forth, and it's almost dizzying to watch. And then he just goes airborne. I mean, it's like he's spring-loaded. He just, like, pops up a good 5 feet into the air and catches the fly in his mouth. And what I always say is that in order to do this, it's not just about knowing where the fly is. It's about knowing where the fly is going. Because in the split second that it takes you to go airborne, the fly will have moved. And I always imagine the conversations among the flies. Like, did you see Carl get caught by that eyeless cat? Carl's got like 100 eyes. And Carl was an idiot. But he does it. He's good.
I would love to see that. We have an email here from Tom Bickford, who writes for us from Silver Spring, Maryland, on this issue. For humans, the dominant sense is sight. As you've said, for other animals, the other senses are more significant in their lives. Dogs would probably say, I smell what you mean. Pit vipers, including the rattlesnake, locate their victims by heat. The cat uses other senses than humans. Good for the cat, but do not judge him by human values. Humans can also learn to use other senses, including the brain, to learn how to get along in the world. I know I am blind.
There you go. Now it's, again, I think people always approach... I think even the people who thought that Homer wouldn't be able to live a good life, or that he would be handicapped, or that he would always be helpless, and that it would be kinder to put him to sleep, I think really are, A, imagining how they would feel if they lost their vision, and are also inaccurately imagining what that experience would be like. And I think in the end... the person who just emailed is absolutely right, that it is a different experience for animals in general, that Homer is certainly better off, you know, being able to hear and smell probably in the end if he had to lose a sense. And that regardless, it's just going to be different. The psychology of it is going to be very different.
At one point, I think after you moved out of your friend's, you were living in a temporary apartment with your friend, and after you moved out, you moved into your parents' house.
Yes.
And they are dog lovers and have dogs. Now, how did both the dog lovers, who are your parents, and the dogs themselves respond? Not just to your three cats, but of course to Homer specifically.
Right. Well, they didn't actually really get a chance to respond to the other two cats. What we did was, when I moved in with my parents, we sort of constructed a dog zone and a cat zone in the house. And there was sort of like a, you know, Berlin Wall kind of a thing separating the two. Which was, you know, a childproof, you know, a series of childproof gates from when my sister and I were younger. So my parents at first didn't really know what to do with cats or to make of cats. They'd always been dog people. They kept telling me what I was doing wrong with the cats based upon their experiences with dogs, you know, ways that I could make the cats friendlier and more dog-like. And, you know, so it was really Homer who bridged the divide. Homer, once he figured out that he could jump over those childproof gates, did so continuously. And so in that sense, came in contact with the other two dogs, one of whom was rather big. She was a lab mix, a lab mutt. And the other one was a sort of miniature cocker spaniel, kind of a mutt. And They actually ended up getting along really well. You know, the bigger dog, Casey, who's a very sweet dog, and she liked to, like, kind of pin Homer down and clean him with her tongue, which for a cat is an excruciating experience, to be cleaned by a dog, to be licked clean by a dog. And Brandy, I think, just liked having somebody littler than she was to play with. And so the two of them would play together. And my parents really, you know, I always say, my parents always say, they've said this for the last decade, if anything were, God forbid, ever to happen to me, they would take care of Homer. And I always ask them what they mean, you know, what they envision happening to me. And they're never specific, but God forbid, if something happens to you, we will take care of Homer. And they, at least once a year, every year for the past 10 years, have reiterated this sentiment to me.
Let's go to Patricia in Mayfield Village, Ohio.
Good morning, and thank you both for this wonderful program, and best wishes to Diane. You've spoken about this odyssey of Homer's at your apartment and your cats and now the dogs. What about other predators? And, for instance, do you walk this any of your cats, including Homer, on a leash? And with birds, is it the same type of thing as with the flies? Secondly, what do you think is having too many cats as pets? And thirdly, I would like Homer's pawgraph before he gets,
before he gets too big.
Thank you so much.
You know, it's Homer. My cats and I, we're all city dwellers. When I lived in Miami, we lived in the suburbs, which, you know, I wouldn't have let any of my cats be indoor outdoor cats, just because we either always lived in apartments or on the kinds of streets where there was enough traffic that I would have felt it was not safe. So Homer's never really had the experience of coming into contact with anything as large as a bird or a pigeon or anything. The biggest thing he's hunted are cockroaches. And you should not discount the size of Miami cockroaches, because they are enormous. But he did, of course, also encounter that burglar who is much bigger than a bird or me, or anyone else, and Homer went after it really as accurately and fearlessly as he goes after anything else. In terms of how many cats are too many, I think that comes down to the amount of space you have, the personalities of the cats that you have. I think there's a point where you can have too many of any kind of animal crammed into too small of a space, and it's stressful and uncomfortable for the animals, you know, in hoarding type situations. But I think that's an extreme. I think that's really, look, personally, if I had a bigger home, and my husband is going to love hearing this, if we had a bigger home, if I had my druthers, I would have dogs and cats and horses and goats and chickens. And
Manhattan
I would live,
might not be the right place for
not
you, Gwen.
Not so much. But, you know, so I feel, you know, it comes down to a matter of space and the personalities of the animals you have. If the only cat I had left was Scarlet, if she lives the longest and she's 22, I can't bring another cat into her life at that point because of her personality and her age. It wouldn't be comfortable for her. But when she was a kitten, I brought in two more kittens in pretty quick succession. So
let's go to Corrine in Dallas, Texas. Corrine, you've joined the program.
Thank you, Kathy. And I'm really interested in the book. I think I found the best Christmas present for all of my cat lover friends. I can't wait to go get it. My question is more around how I would think that this is very inspiring to a lot of people to think, oh, I'd like to go get a special needs pet now, which is wonderful. But I think that there are probably some tips that you might have, or how to go about finding one, or how to even go about finding if you've got the right personality and home life to support the needs of a special needs animal.
I think that's a really good question. you know, in terms of finding special needs pets, there are organizations that serve special needs pets exclusively. I actually do want to mention Blind Cat Rescue and Sanctuary, Inc. in North Carolina. They are a permanent no-kill shelter for blind cats specifically, and they would probably be a good, you know, housing place of resources, let's say, for identifying or finding special needs cats in other places. I think in terms of identifying, I think the two things that are required, personality and circumstances-wise, I think in terms of circumstances, you have to look at how calm versus chaotic your home life is. And I don't mean chaotic in a bad way. I think if you have three or four young children, or if you have several large dogs, you know, my veterinarian who treated Homer, even aside from the fact that her son was allergic, she had two large dogs, she had a toddler, she was planning to have more children. It was not necessarily going to be an ideal environment for a blind cat, no matter how resourceful and how scrappy and how much like other cats. So I think that is one thing. Again, I don't think there are any hard and fast rules, but it is something to keep in mind. I think in terms of personality, I think you have to really ask yourself if you're willing to be patient. If you're willing to say to yourself, I don't know what this is going to be. I don't know exactly what's going to be required of me, but I am willing to commit to that I don't know, no matter what it is. And, you know, again, I think some people realistically just can't do it. There are just going to be circumstances in their lives that are not going to make that ideal. But I think even more than patience is sort of the ability to say, I don't know what this is going to be, but I'm signing up for this unknowable thing, and I will ride it out wherever it goes.
Do you think when you speak at the beginning of the book about how having Homer, in a sense, forced you to grow up, Gwen, is that what you're talking about?
I think that's certainly part of it. I think I definitely ended up making different individual decisions along the way. You know, I would say, for example, Homer had a very definite impact as a single woman on my dating life. There were a few simple rules in my apartment. I lived in an apartment with a balcony and a balcony door. I did not let anyone into my apartment who, unless I felt very sure that they would not even for a second go out on the balcony while my back was turned and forget to close that door, because that is a lapse of a second that can very easily become a household tragedy. So things like that. There was a real vetting process that at that age were not things that I'd necessarily thought about. It was not a context that I put it into. I'd never had a sense of my dating life affecting anybody but me. And this is just one example and one sort of set of decisions, but it was a lot of things like that. There were a lot of things, the type of home that I was going to live in, the type of jobs that I was going to have, the amount of travel or being away from home that they would require. There were just, you know, again, because while Homer is still, in the end, basically like any other cat and is so extraordinary taking care of himself, there are always those hazards and pitfalls that you need to be mindful of and that you need to know that other people who come into your life are going to be mindful of. And so all of a sudden, you know, I was a single girl in her early mid-20s who had the same sort of dating criteria that a single mother might have in terms of when do people get to come into my home and under what circumstances and when do I trust them, you know, enough to be there, let's say, unsupervised. And it was a change. I mean, I think really ultimately for the better. I think it was certainly a point in my life where it was high time that I started thinking about things like that.
I'm Cathy Kay. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to join us, please do call 1-800-433-8850. You can send those emails to drshow@wamu.org or find us on Facebook or even send us a tweet. Let's go back to the phones now to Edna in Raleigh, North Carolina. Edna, you've joined The Diane Rehm Show.
Oh, yes, very good. I had a kitty cat, and she was several years old. I think a car must have hit her one night, and she was blind, and the vet didn't tell me any of the things that might happen. And so when I got home with her, all she could do was to bop her head, beat her head against the walls from corner to corner, and for a couple of days, and I just decided I couldn't see her because she was a much-loved cat. And so then we had to put her to sleep. Of course, she was buried in satin and in a very formal way of burial. But then I began to hear that cats do not have the sense, as a dog does, to go with being blind. But when you have said that Homer had the senses, I was surprised. So that's what I was asking. You think it's because it was an older cat? My cat was an older cat?
You know, I'm not sure. I think for a cat like a person who becomes suddenly blind, that there is going to be a period of adjustment. And, you know, I don't know. How old was the cat?
I think we've lost Edmund.
Okay. You know, and again, there could be an age where it is, you know, too old. I mean, if a cat is 17 or 18 and loses their vision, that's a decision that you have to make. How well you see the cat making that adjustment and you know, what you think the quality of life is going to be. And I don't think there are any hard and fast answers in either direction. I think certainly, again, it's going to be different for a person who's born blind as opposed to a person who becomes blind later in life. I think in general, adjustments can be made. But again, so much is going to come down to the age and the health and the personality of the individual animal or the individual person that you can't really say definitively one way or the other. Although the one thing I will say definitively, and I am an equal opportunity dog and cat person, but I think if the cats out there were listening and could understand, they would get a good laugh out of being told that their senses were not as good as dogs, and would probably be quite indignant on their own behalf. So I will take up that mantle for them.
Okay, Gwen, we just have a minute left on the program. And before we go, I want to ask you what you would like to say to Homer at the end of this program, if Homer is listening.
You know, I know he must be sitting there with my husband right now and hearing my voice over the radio and completely unable to understand why he's hearing my voice when I am not there. This is a new experience for him. So I was going to say, hi, Homer Bear, which is my name for him, because he's this beautiful black coat like a grizzly bear. So I always call him Homer Bear. Hi, Homer Bear. And that's it.
And this is the cat that has changed your life.
This is the cat who has changed my life, but he does not have to hear me say that to know that.
And also, you don't want him getting too cocky, this wonder
we're
cat.
We're trying to keep his head from getting too big.
Gwen Cooper is the author of Homer's Odyssey, A Fearless Feline Tale, or How I Learned About Love and Life with a Blind Wonder Cat. Gwen Cooper, it's been a great hour. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Katty Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thank you all so much for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.